Welcome to Grounded with Earth Optics. My name is Gunnar Bodvarsson. I'm joined here by my co-host Piper Smith. Piper, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. I can't complain.
You've been up to anything fun recently?
What was that?
You've been up to anything fun recently?
Yes, I just got back from the Adirondacks, actually. Three weeks.
What was the favorite thing you did up there?
Okay, we did a lot of hiking, a lot of berry picking, but my favorite thing that we did, to my husband's dismay, was we went to the North Pole, which is like a Christmas-themed theme park from like the 40s. It like predates Disneyland, and it is totally a blast from the past. It's like teeny tiny roller coasters and people in Santa Claus costumes. So maybe not my favorite, but definitely the most unique thing we did while we were
Nice. I myself had the worst weekend. I went and bought a new putter, went golfing, and played probably the worst round of my entire life. So I think I'm just going to return all those clubs and find a new hobby. But maybe podcasting is my true calling. But all right, we're joined today with James Clement. James, can you please introduce yourself?
Hey, Piper. Hey, Gunnar. James Clement. I work with Earth Optics, and thanks for having me on today.
Of course. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself, James? I think Piper and I know you pretty well at this point, but you've got a long career. Not that you're old or anything, but you've done a lot, and we'd love to hear a little bit more about it.
I think you're underselling James. James is one of the most interesting men with optics. So James, take it away.
Thanks. So both sides of my family have been ranching combined almost 400 years. So my mother's side in Northwest Texas, Beggs Cattle Company, and since 1876, and my dad's King Ranch since 1853. And then we have another personal operation in South Texas that we've had since the 60s. And after my career's, I was ranching kind of growing up out of college. I worked in Australia and Florida on some ranches in Texas. And then I joined the Marine Corps for kind of a stint, and then I came back to ranching, and then I left again to go back to the Marine Corps to be an officer, and was gone for a while, then came back and went to King Ranch for 10 years. At King Ranch, I worked at the horse program and then managed it for about 8 years. And then I became a landman, which is a term used in Texas more than elsewhere, but kind of the middleman between anybody who comes on your property. So that could be fence line issues, pipeline, power lines, oil and gas, and then more often lately, renewables and carbon projects. And so I worked on a little bit on a direct air capture project, but then really the most fun I had, I was working on a soil carbon project with Exxon, funded it with B Carbon. And I met Lars and the team out on the job. I spent 5 days driving around, watching them sample and everything. And a couple months later, I asked Lars for a job. And so I've been here over a year and a half now at Earth Optics. And then I'm still ranching, though. We've got a few properties that I lease in South Texas with some partners. And then my wife and I have a personal place, too, that we bought. And we're trying to – we grow cattle and horses, and we try to do a few different things in the business, and also are trying to do a little this intense grazing. So moving the cattle, you know, kind of replicating the bison effect and experimenting with that. We're having some success there. And so I'm also kind of two hats. I'm a customer of Earth Optics through B Carbon and through Grassroots Carbon. And then I also work here. So so in my role managing range and grassland, I do the rancher engagement side. So I talk to ranchers about this opportunity, about why I believe in it, and then sometimes developers, sometimes food companies, sometimes buyers of credits, and everywhere in between. So just like all of us Earth Optics, I wear a lot of hats and kind of try to flex to the opportunities we're working on.
Awesome. Yeah. What opportunities are you speaking of there?
Well, like just actually yesterday and today, I got to meet with Laura Turner Seidel, who's Ted Turner's daughter, and they manage a lot of ranch land across the West. And then Alan Williams from Understanding Ag, and he's the one of the regenerative ranching coaches of that group, and then a few regen ranchers from the Austin Fredericksburg area. And then this morning we went to the Rome Ranch, R-O-A-M, and they're a future customer of ours, by the way. And we, you know, we're watching their bison and their and what they've done to. They took a property that was over farmed over a number of years, and they kind of converted it into a more holistic ranching operation. They have chickens, they have turkeys, all sorts of wildlife, and then they have these bison there. And, you know, seeing what they've done, you know, replenish topsoil, build back grasslands. They have a creek there that they said for almost 100 years didn't keep water in it. Now with their efforts, they've recharged their water table. They brought back the seepage, the underground water flowing into that creek, and now it's also collecting water. And so, you know, they brought back this whole living ecosystem back to their place. And so that's one, you know, highly successful, extreme example of some of the things I get to do. But often it's, so ranching for me, you know, I mean, I told you we've been in it for generations, and cattle and horses are, I tell people that's my golf. Like that, I'll always do that. That's what I love doing. And I'm growing it to be more and more of a business for me too, on this personally. But I want to do everything I can that influences and benefits ranching. And I really believe that this soil carbon industry is something that, for twofold. One, provides more information for the land manager or landowner. And then two, also provides a new revenue source, new cash flow for an operation. And then I guess three, too, it's with all the kind of information we receive nowadays about the, are cattle good for the environment? Is ranching good? Are the ways that we've ranched forever? And trying to disprove that and trying to recruit the next generation to want to do this, because they realize, like, ranching is one of the things, if not the thing, that is most important, because our grasslands, like we know from Earth Optics, are the most important ecosystem on Earth in terms of storage of carbon and the cycle of nature. And also, you know, everything that we equate extreme weather to, that we think it is, I believe a lot of that is due to overdevelopment. And if we can protect these grasslands and encourage people to manage them in the best possible way, we can keep this ranching tradition that is my culture, for many more years. So that was kind of a big answer to your question, Gunnar, but that's a few of the things.
James, you mentioned your family's been in this since the late 1800s on both sides. How do you think the landscape has changed for ranchers, you know, in the last 100, 150 years?
Well, so literally, when the landscape before Europeans really settled, was Texas was mostly grass. You know, East Texas was piney, but the middle of Texas was all these grasslands. And you read these histories where they say grass was stirrup high. The Spaniards, prior to the real European expansion, the Spaniards came across and got lost because so much of Texas was this rolling grasslands, and they couldn't even get their bearing. And now, when the Spanish brought cattle and horses, you know, the wild horses, because, you know, my dad's operation from South Texas, that we call it that area the birthplace of American ranching, because that's where the Spanish kind of missions met the European farming traditions and kind of built up what became known as ranching. And but with that, you know, you had 100,000 or more wild horses. You had the original longhorns that the earth had ever seen, because those were developed. You know, people don't realize, but longhorns were actually a Darwinism effect. These cattle came from Europe. The Europeans left. The Native Americans didn't really mess with the cattle as much because they were more bison. That was more their diet. And so these longhorns were fighting, or these cattle were fighting bears and wolves and all these animals. And the ones that had the horns could survive. So these horns kept growing longer and longer. And in 100 years, this new species, or not new species, but new breed of cow came about. And that, you know, that's what we call the Texas longhorn. But there was also hundreds of thousands of them all over Mexico and Texas and the Southwest. And so with that, they changed the ecosystem. So they went, and the horses especially went and ate on these brush species that were in northern Mexico. And then as they trampled and ran, they spread these brush species out and changed the landscape quite literally. And then, but I guess what you were probably talking more about, the actual landscape in terms of the business, The business has changed dramatically. Like, just again, taking the King Ranch example, that we started out, my ancestor was a riverboat captain, came from Ireland via New York, ran away from home. We don't know his parents. That was lost. He jumped on a ship, went to the Carolinas, Florida, finally made his way to Texas. And then, it was out of Brownsville running riverboats, and, actually Boca Chica, also right where Elon Musk's, rockets are taking off now. And he was running the boats up and down the river. And then as he went across the land in South Texas, he found this virgin landscape. And as he saw that then the post Civil War happened and the beef boom. So beef cattle was king for a period. So all these people started buying land and buying ranches and getting in this business. And in about a 20-year period, that market kind of broke because it became oversaturated. And then from the late 19th century to the early 20th century, there was drought. There was the Depression. The markets were pretty tough. And so there was a 50-year period where ranching was very difficult, and really just grit and wanting to remain with those people that you built that with and the communities was the only thing keeping it. And then when the world wars happened, beef became a high demand again. And then during that also oil and gas. So these two markets came back in. And so they became another rise in this whole ranching industry. And then post World War II, it's changed dramatically because the kind of, again, the wildlife flourished. And so wildlife became more and more a commodity, you know, in terms of tourism and hunting and all of those things. But also and then today it's now become this, it's such a rare occurrence to find real, you know, native or well-kept land that it's a different kind of tourism, right? It's people that want to hike. It's people want to see that. And also the ranchers are also the protectors of these lands and stewarding these ecosystems. So there's all these big groups out there that do tremendous things to protect lands. But I think the private landowners in the U.S. are as good as anybody in terms of protecting land and kind of learning what's the best things to do with their soil. And again, that's why Earth Optics was interesting to me, because it is the number one thing. You know, how are you taking care of the soil? What are you doing with it? Why? And how does that help your productivity? And not making decisions that are annual based, you know, just based on a market of beef or market of what you farm, but what's good for a 10 or 20 year decision. And that I really love that part of this business, is that you're trying to make generational decisions, not annual or quarterly decisions like a lot of other businesses.
You said generational, someone who's not been in the ranching community but attended recently CattleCon with you, James, in Orlando. Something that impressed me or surprised me or shouldn't have surprised me about that conference was just the amount of multi-generational families in attendance and the multi-generational ranchers and that family unit and how important it is in the ranching community. And I think a lot of the ranches I've had the privilege of working with, similar to your story, have been in the family for decades, if not a century.
Absolutely. And it that's the other thing too, as these families grow, you know, it might only be one or two people that are directly engaged, but as long as they can provide value for the rest of them, like you see Piper, like an enthusiasm for those other folks in their family, that's what keeps us going. Because if there's more lucrative things that you can do than agriculture. And so you have to want to do it. And it's a wonderful life if you get to be a part of the land and have a connection with it.
Yeah. What about ranching do you really appreciate? You know, you've got this familial tie to it where I'm sure there's some kind of responsibility you've inherited. But, you know, Piper and I can just tell the way that you're speaking about ranching, it's clear you do have a very genuine love for it. So what is it about ranching and just land management at large that you really find so inspiring and motivating?
I think one, it's tangible, right? It's this is our dirt. We're stewards of this dirt. We are for, again, it's not for us. It's for grandkids and great grandkids down the road. And also just what you can do for those animals, because you become the caretaker of all of that. And also too, you know, as I've learned more about it, since I've been involved with this discussion, it's made me kind of chase the defense of our industry too, right? And like this book I'm reading now from the Nyman family, Defending Beef, and they're talking about the fact that in terms of inputs, natural resource inputs, water, grass, land, the best yield that you can get in terms of calories for a human, protein for a human, is based on livestock, because everything else, if you look into it, has kind of a darker side that maybe is not shown enough. And so as we toil with our soil and kind of try to make the best decisions of it, it's actually making a positive effect on, you know, the health of the country and the health of the people you're around. You know, now it's even become a discussion of, like people say, the next wars will be fought on food and water, not on whatever else they've been fought on for all these years. And it becomes a national security issue too, in terms of, you know, protecting your land, everything like that. And there's even discussions now about making military forces more self-sustainable, growing their own food, you know, being stewards of their own land. And it's funny because that, nothing is new, right? It's all repetitive. And the missions that I told you in the beginning, the Catholic Church came and you know, tried to work with the Indians to build a community, and they had farms and ranches, and that was part of it. They were self-sustaining, often very isolated, so they had to do everything for themselves. And ranching is like that. You know, it's what you can do on your own place, that where you don't have to look outside for resources or handouts. It's you can do that yourself. And so those are a few of the reasons I really love it.
That's awesome. Let's pivot a little bit and talk about what you do specifically at Earth Optics. So you're our SVP and general manager of grass and rangeland. You and I sit on a lot of calls together with speaking with different ranchers. And that's always really, really fun. And you work very closely with Piper in kind of the same aspect. What do you do at Earth Optics specifically, and what sort of value are you bringing to ranchers such as yourself?
Yeah, so again, the landman concept that I was talking about. So literally back in the day, there was oil and gas, and these people were knocking on doors of these ranches and saying, look, you might have something under your feet that's worth a lot of money, and it'll be good for your family and for your operation. And so it's really that same conversation, except, you know, oil and gas has their history, and everybody can comment on that, whatever. But now what's beneath your feet is your soil. And so really it's making sure a rancher knows that this is not too good to be true. This is real, this soil carbon opportunity. And then also, you know, that I don't get to work enough on the, you know, when we test compaction, nutrients, moisture, the other things we test. But I really love that too, where instead of the years and years where somebody had to spend learning about their land and what's best for it and most productive, now that these tools are being developed from the AI that's able to learn faster and provide history immediately and provide plans immediately or solutions more quickly. And so a young rancher can take that information and make a decision, or, you know, again, get into these soil carbon markets. And then, you know, the attach that carbon credit, or hopefully the other credits. I mean, I see a future of moisture credits. I see a future of biodiversity credits. Not just me, a lot of other people do. But attaching those credits to the products you sell, the beef, the corn, the crops, whatever you're selling off your land, if you're doing it with a high regard for the land, then you can add value. Just like the people did with the grass-fed or the organic, or attaching that seal of approval, it's the same kind of thing. And that, I know we've both worked on, you know, these Audubon projects and World Wildlife Fund. And that's great too, because for years, I mean, since Val Lehman in the 40s, 50s, 60s in South Texas was first talking about the benefit of livestock for wildlife, it's taken until really the last 10 years where a lot more of the NGO and wildlife community is now, instead of saying, hey, remove the cattle, remove the private landowner, we need to be state or nationally owned parks and stuff, now they're saying, no, what these stewards of the land are doing is actually helping encourage more birds. It's encouraging more wildlife to roam, and it's making it all healthier too, because there's a competition now, and these animals, you know, because of their working on what they want to browse, what they want to eat, what they want to live off of, the water they drink. That's helping make a decision process and everything too.
How do you think, the ranching community at large is informed of this opportunity? And if not, you know, like what would your advice be for folks who are circling it, but, you know, not quite willing to dip a toe in the water or heading that direction? Like, where would they get started?
So, you know, again, I've been looking at this for less than 3 years, been here for a year and a half. And even when I got here a year and a half, it was kind of polite rejections, I guess, from a lot of people I'd talked to about it. And then as you see every month, it feels like there's not really the rejections anymore. Everybody's listening. Not everybody's ready to move forward with these ideas. But and sometimes it might take till the next generation an older generation saying, you know what, I'll focus on this, what I've been doing. You focus on that to the next generation. So it can be that high five to the next generation saying, hey, you learn about that and if it's something we should pursue. But it's absolutely being taken seriously. And that's another reason why I've told people if this ceases to be a landowner-friendly industry or environment, I won't be in it. And I don't and the reason I'm in it is to make sure and drive that conversation towards a landowner-friendly. Because, again, I use that oil and gas analogy a lot. Like in the beginning of that, there was a rush, right? Once people started realizing it was beneficial, there was a monetary incentive and there was opportunity, people started taking advantage of situations. And so if we can have landowners inside the conversation in the beginning, during the development stage, now it's always a landowner pro conversation. And we're always directing that towards what is best for the landowner, because they are the ones that are providing the data. They are the ones that are providing the credit. They are the ones that are providing the benefit. And so they are the ones that should in turn benefit from anything that comes of it, at least the lion's share. But and then we, Earth Optics and the developers we work with, and Qatari Agricapture, I already mentioned Grassroots and B Carbon, and a host of others that are out there. I know Range Carbon out of Houston too is another one that's developing now. They, you know, there's got to be an incentive for them to get involved, because a rancher doesn't really have the time to go learn how to do soil sampling at like Earth Optics, or to sit and figure out where they're going to sell their credits or develop that whole segment. And you saw that back in the day too. A lot of people tried to run their own oil and gas operations, and a very small percentage were successful. And a lot of people went broke chasing that. And so if we can just create that really, you know, well done, you know, what sound operation, I guess I should say, that that is trustworthy, then we can get the rancher, more and more ranchers recruited to this cause.
Yeah, and I like that you talked about the learning that's required, especially on the rancher's part. Not only because it involves oftentimes these programs practice changes, and that's of course why it's so incredibly important that landowners are involved in these conversations, because it needs to be people with boots on the ground experience and who are understanding of how any practice change might affect your operation, but also every rancher or landowner is in a completely different scenario. Everybody has their own land, and not everybody is necessarily suited for a carbon project. You know, not everybody necessarily has the same potential to sequester carbon as others. So in your opinion, what does it look like for a rancher who is either way out west or up in North Dakota or even in upstate New York? How does the context by which that rancher lives in kind of determine how they navigate these different paths?
Yeah, and a couple things that from your question there, Gunnar, the practice change is something that can scare people off, right? And also additionality scares people off, because a lot of these ranchers will say, well, I've been doing a good job, or we've been doing a good job. And so I try to always make sure they know, like, look, this is not we're not trying to judge your operation. There's always a way. And that's why I feel like this approach is the best way where we can move forward. It's a capitalistic approach to making people want to be better stewards, right? Because this is data. We can't argue with data. This is where your soil is now. You know, there's an opportunity. Avoided conversion is a great thing too for us, because even if we can get to a point where conservation easements are the same way, where a commit to not develop, a commit to not do row crops, a commit to keep native land native, Like, that's step one. And so most ranchers are already in step one, right? And then, as you say, well, here's what you can get paid for that, and they get the check for that. Then they kind of look at it and they go, well, how can I make more money doing this? And it's like, I'm glad you asked. Let's talk about that. And or it's like, hey, you're already doing it. Now, I tell people too, people say, oh, I've already hit my plateau, or I can't be ranching any better. That's always up to the eye of the beholder, right? And a lot of this land in the U.S., it took us 200 plus years to degrade or to learn what was best. So don't think that just because you changed 10, 20, 30 years ago that you've hit a plateau or you can't be any better. And it's also cyclical with the weather patterns too, and how a rancher adapts to that weather. Because the people that don't make a proactive change for the benefit of their land, that's the ones that maybe would have the most trouble. But as long as you're being a good steward and being proactive in your decisions and basing the number of cattle you have on your property, or how you manage your wildlife, or how you even develop your infrastructure, where you put waters, where you put fences, that all can benefit, and that all can be qualified as a quote unquote practice change. And so I always try to make sure that they realize that point too. But to answer your question, everybody should be looking at this in some regard, no matter their rainfall, no matter their soil type, no matter their elevation, because there's always an opportunity to consider. Now, you're right. Does everybody, quote unquote, qualify? Not necessarily. Maybe not now. Maybe not with the current state. But that doesn't mean that there's not a program that's being developed or an outfit that is looking into something that's a new way to do it. And again, most of our contracts that we do with these people, not Earth Optics, but the developers, are what I tell people, like a short-term conservation easement. It's hard to tell somebody, hey, don't do anything with this place forever because you've devalued their land. But if you can say, hey, for 15 years, commit to these things or keep doing this for 15 years, they can say, okay, I can say that because, I'm 40, and by the time I'm 55, I'll still be running this place. But if you're saying 30 years, maybe I don't want to make a decision for my children because I don't know what position they'll be in. And so you got to take that into consideration too. But I tell people, as long as you're making good, sound decisions for your place, as long as you don't want to sell the place tomorrow, and as long as you're not going to, change dramatically to a negative effect the quality of your soil, there's an opportunity for anyone out there.
Yeah, it sounded like I'm sorry, Pecker.
No, I was going to say, I think you're right. And I think we all the time hear people say that the carbon market is like the wild, wild west. So, there's some tied to ranching in that alone. But it really is, I think, anybody's game right now. Especially there is an opportunity for pretty much anyone with the way things are rolling.
And the other reason why I liked Earth Optics in particular was, we're here to generate the data. We're not here to sell you something or take a portion of whatever you have or whatever like that. And some people say, well, I'm going to wait. It's like, well, what are you waiting for? Because getting the data of your soil, you don't need to wait for that. What you need to be waiting for, or what you need to get, is the information now, so that as you're making these decisions, as you're making these improvements, if there's an ability to capture a market there, you're able to capture that. And the other thing too I love is that, again, back to the oil and gas analogy, a lot of oil and gas leases back in the day were a hard stop. They were a certain percentage, didn't change, where, like we know, these carbon markets are market dependent. So if you sign it, 20 acres a ton today, and it's 25 next year, you're going to make the 25 next year because that's what you're signing up for, because these companies want to be, they're percentage based. Almost every contract I've seen is percentage based. So as the market increases, all parties are benefiting from that. But then Earth Optics has also doubled down the other direction. We're saying, look, the better we get, the more information we have, the less time we have to spend on your ranch, the less data we have to collect. Adam, that works at our company, our COO, he made the comment one time, our goal is one day to not have to take soil samples to be able to do this from imagery. And I don't know if we'll ever get to not, because we always have to, ground truth, the old name of our company, we always have to prove it out. But it's a bold statement, and it shows that every time we do something, we're learning more about the soil and the land and how we as a company can also grow in this. And that's why I really like being at Earth Optics too.
I like the point that you raised about, you know, taking the measurements and that that's what Earth Optics is here to do. And that's true. And I think what always, you can't go back in time, right? You can go back in time and measure the soil 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 30 years ago, but you can measure it today. And even if folks aren't, you know, there is a cost associated, but even if you're not going out or have a strict plan, getting that kind of baseline measurement of where your dirt is at today is important. And I know our lab manager, our soil scientist, will punish me for calling it dirt and not soil, but.
Well, James.
Well, and the other joke too, is that like, and we've all heard it, is like, well, no, I'm better than my neighbor. So sample me and sample my neighbor. And you just, you know, pay me the difference. It's like, oh yeah, your neighbor's going to love that. You know, like, let's throw him under the bus, you know? But no, it's, yeah, it is. I totally agree.
Well, if you're worse off, you got farther to go to improve, right? I mean,
that's the best part, right? You know, when your land is the worst, it's the best time to start.
Yeah.
Well, so James, because Piper brought up an interesting point saying you can't go back in time. What do you say to ranchers who tell you, look, I've been doing rotational grazing or rotational stocking as scientists prefer to call it. You know, I've been doing these practices for 20 years and can I get paid retroactively for all of the work I've been doing? You know, how do you get questions like that? And how do those conversations typically go?
If a rancher cares about their land, his or her land, and they say that I'm doing the best possible job and I can't make it any better, they're lying to themselves, right? Like, if you truly care about the land and you think you've peaked, you're not being truthful with yourself. And that's the best part, right? Is that the best stewards know they can be better. And so it just takes, I try to get them to come to that conclusion themselves, but it's also very delicate, right? Somebody's been on a place for 50 years. I'm not going to tell them you can be better. I am going to tell them though, but you know, but the best time to start is now.
Yep. 100%. I'd like to switch gears once more, just because I know we've only got about 20 minutes left and I don't want to make your blood boil too much, James, but let's squash the beef. What is the beef with beef? Why do people think that it's bad for the environment? Is that true? Is it just a big rumor? You know, what's going on there? Because I see it all the time and I don't buy it.
It is, we need another podcast for that. But the,
I'm sold.
The biggest thing is that, the most humanely treated animal that we eat on this earth is a range cow, range steer, her progeny, et cetera, because we are literally making that herd's life as easy as possible. We're giving them food. We're giving them water. We're giving them the opportunity to be as healthy as possible by looking after them. And so, you know, I don't want to comment on other proteins out there, but everything else doesn't, I would argue that no other animal is treated as humanely as a beef cow. And then on top of that, what I was saying earlier is that if you look at every, like methane, right? Rice fields emit more methane on a per calorie basis in terms of human consumption per calorie than cattle do. And methane also, you know, everybody wants to talk about methane. Methane is a 10-year cycle. When we're studying carbon, like you all know, is a 10, 20, or 1,000-year carbon cycle. And the cattle are increasing the ability for the carbon to be captured into the ground. And so, yes, they emit methane out of their mouths as part of their rumen. But the other thing about that is that the cattle herd in the U.S. is the lowest since 1950. And some people say, well, the cattle are bigger. They're not. The cattle peaked in about 1980s, 1990s. And now the average size of an animal has gotten smaller over time, more productive, more efficient. And so we're doing more with less. And then Alan Williams, actually this morning, he said that the amount of native ruminants in North America before European settlers was over 200 million. Total number of cows today, I think sitting at beef cattle in North America is like 80 to 90 million. And so now I said ruminants, and that includes all the others. Well, you think of what's happening to all the other, the bison and everything else, there are not the numbers today that there were before we messed with these ecosystems. And we did, like we have altered the course of this land. We all know that. And so the fact that we're able to still feed ourselves with less. And then the other thing too is the demand, right? Like the way that cattle are raised is based on the consumer demand. But the biggest people that fight us, whether they're shrouded in animal rights, they're animal rights shrouded in a methane discussion, right? And so, look, I understand some people just will never get over the fact that we eat animals, but we do. But if you're going to eat animals, beef, in terms of the amount of protein you can get, based on the amount of water consumption for the pound of protein, based on the amount of land used for that pound of protein, and again, all the other vitamins, minerals, and everything else you can benefit from beef and bison and livestock, it is the most efficient food source. And so as long as we can protect these lands and keep, you know, challenging ourselves to be better stewards of these lands, that argument should be shut down. Because it's, and if you look at every study that people usually quote, they're from the 50s to the 2000s, and they extrapolated data from very small test cases that did not represent the entire beef industry. One of the great examples is, you know, rainforests were cut down in Brazil, and those trees emitted carbon when they were cut down. And then soy and corn and other crops were grown there to feed cattle. And they'll say, oh, we got to equate that. Well, they'll use that stat, that tree emission, year after year. Well, that was a one-time occurrence. And guess what? A lot of that soy is used for soy products that's then shipped. And all of the logistics and energy and oil and gas used to ship soy from Brazil to the U.S., and then also any other protein that you would replace beef with is not nearly as efficient, and definitely not as good for the soil and for the land. And the other thing, too, I always tell people, the extreme weather events. We continue to build houses and communities in places that we shouldn't, that are floodplains, places like that. And so they are equating this, which, and again, agriculture in general, I think it's 7% of our carbon emissions in the country, and less than 3% is livestock. And so if you look at the actual facts and data of this, that's an unfair assessment for all of the ranchers out there, and it needs to be squashed. It's just, I guess we as ranchers want to just work, you know, focus on what we're doing and not communicate those statistics to the outside world, or not fight as hard for it. And so, you know, the organizations like National Cattlemen's Beef and Texas Cattle Raisers are out there trying to promote our message, but we've got to do a better job, just like podcasts like this. And we're talking soil mostly, but we've got to do a better job of promoting what we do for the world. And some of the things I already discussed.
I might be biased as someone who is married to a man who eats a lot of beef and has four boys, who I expect the beef rations in this house will always be high. But I can also say, when I interviewed for this job, the first person I talked to was our COO at the time, Chad Fish, and he was calling in from King Ranch. And all I heard him say as he was going on the side-by-side was like, look, there's a flamingo. Oh, look, there's a hog going by. I mean, we were on the phone 3 minutes, and he's just like spewing off all the wildlife that he was seeing. And finally, I think it ended with, gotta go, click, you know, something along those lines. But that's been my experience. And the ranchers that we've worked on, I mean, we see the pics coming from our field techs. You know, they always have some element of beauty built into the ranch themselves. The ones I've been on have been beautiful. So
that stat, like, so that was a rosy spoonbill. We don't have flamingos down there, but he was close. But there are more species of birds in South Texas than anywhere in North America, and all of that land is rangeland with cattle on it and horses and other livestock, and so that's a. If more species of birds show up to a place, like you all know too, if more bugs are showing up, another thing we talk about is you wake up in the morning in South Texas and there's spider webs everywhere. Spiders are apex predators of the insects. They're there because all the insects are there. And then the birds are there for all the insects as well. And so this is how you build these things on top of each other. And so, I mean, I totally agree with you too.
I think even grass-fed beef just... regeneratively grazed beef just tastes so much better too than, you know, a beef grown on a stockyard. I think the entire regenerative grazing movement is so amazing from the standpoint of empowering growers from, you know, additional financial means, but also all the co-benefits that come along with it, you know, better tasting products, rehabilitating those streams and waterways, you know, cleaner water, enhancing biodiversity and bringing those insect populations back. I think there's certainly an argument to be made about stockyards and you know, mass production facilities, really anything being mass produced or any sort of monocrop is that just goes against ecological principles. It's hard to argue that that's going to be beneficial in any way. But in the, you know, in the case of what we're talking about today, which is this regenerative grazing movement, you know, adding these practices to your operation that utilize your cattle in the way that the bison used to naturally roam. It's just such a long list of co-benefits where it's like, why would you not do that? And for, you know, in the case of myself, I've got a 15 cubic foot freezer in my garage that is almost overflowing right now because my girlfriend and I bought a half cow from a rancher out in South Dakota a month or two ago. And even just getting a chance to talk to, you know, the person who grew your food is a really incredible experience. And it's just amazing to see how circular it is, you know, going from the administration that I forget his first name, Earl Butz or whatever his name was, who was, you know, get big or get out. And seeing it go from that, you know, mass production perspective back to the much smaller and more intensive management that focuses on the product itself and not just quantity.
And two things you brought up there. So one, our host this morning at the Rome Ranch, she and her husband were triathletes years ago, and she had a bunch of joint issues, and they were vegans. And she went to see numerous doctors, and it was getting so bad that there was even a discussion about amputation. And her doctor at the time said, "I want you to go eat beef right now." And within a month, all of her ailments went away. And that sounds like a made up story, but I heard it this morning from somebody who not only did that, but then they eventually bought a ranch and they started two Epic Meats. They sold that to General Mills. Then they started Force of Nature, another meat company too. And now they're all in on the benefits of this. But I will, Gudar, I have to, our friends in the feed yards, I have to make a defense there. It's the American diet that drives the feed yard market, right? And as we get better at more in tune to what we eat and our connection to nature, I'd love to see that. But the yards still have a absolute purpose in this country. And in terms of an efficiency side and the amount of, again, water, pounds of feed to generate pounds of protein, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I've got to put in that plug. But I'm with you. Like, I'd love to see more ranchers being approached from people to buy their protein right off the ranch, because that also helps the ranch.
Yeah, and I have nothing against feedlots or anybody running feedlots. I'm going to one in 2 weeks down in Nebraska, and so I'm all for that as well. But I think I myself, you know, my own personal story of getting into agriculture was very much from the, you know, I went to a small liberal arts college where it was, I would say in general, kind of anti-ag, at least the student body. A lot of the professors were of course, much better educated than us about what was really going on. But it was interesting to see, you know, what I was taught in school. And then I went to actually work on farms and I was like, oh, so this is what it's really like. Like everything I learned in school wasn't wrong, but I was given a very jaded perspective. And then I, as I continued to meet more growers and work for other growers, it was just really eye-opening from that, you know, the smallest scale possible going up. But no, I completely agree with everything you just said, James. We've got, it's a very complex issue, and there's no reason to point fingers at anybody in particular.
I gotta say, yeah, Gunnar, you bought your cow and filled a 15 cubic foot freezer, but I got a Florida cracker cow, and that was about 4 cubic feet for a half house.
The other half of my everything is all salmon and fish. I got plenty of other stuff in there too, but the cow definitely took up a lot of the space. But I'm getting through it.
I will say that's the right. Florida cracker was delicious, but small.
Well, James, I've got one really, really big question for you. What do you prefer, horses or cattle?
It's I couldn't say that in public, you know. It's like choosing between your children, Gunnar.
Well, I don't have that luxury, so.
You don't want to have to choose. Someone asked me, which one would you give up first? And I said, oh my gosh, we can't even go down that conversation.
There you go.
Well, James, what are you excited about for what's to come with carbon markets, with regenerative grazing, with your personal life? Anything that you're excited about in particular?
I'm excited about the recruitment, right? You know, both y'all's stories about how you got to Earth Optics, you know, that I love hearing that, right? Like you gravitated towards it because of everything that surrounds everything we're doing. And that's how we get people connected back to the land. And so I love that. And then, on the marketing side, I mean, you know, you're looking at these foreign countries and they're 3 and 4x on the soil carbon credit market. And I mean, this is, I told someone a while back, and I've said it again numerous times, but this is the first time in a long time where, because the cow is necessary for this carbon cycle, like we already discussed, and the surface, the actual agriculture operation, that for in these next few years, it might be the most revenue that a rancher receives, not oil and gas, not renewables, not, you know, ecotourism, which is great, but a rancher wants to ranch. And the fact that we might get to a place where either they're attaching these credits, whatever, to their beef or to their land or whatever, that the ranching itself might actually be the most lucrative thing someone can do with the land again in these next few years. And that's really exciting for me.
Yeah, well said. I love it. Well, James, thank you very much for joining us today. I think this was long overdue, even though we've only been doing this for a couple months. I know I was super excited to talk to you a bit more.
Super. Spurred about 7 more podcasts I'd like to do with you.
No kidding.
I'm in. And I'd love to bring people to the show too. And cause I think this is just a great, I'm glad you two are doing this, cause I think this is a great opportunity to spread the word here.
Definitely.
Thanks, James. All right, everyone. Thank you for joining us for another episode. Stay grounded.